this sounds like science fiction, but it's science fact. This is happening. Why don't more people have access to invest in this incredible technology and to generate the financial returns associated with it? And so that was my inspiration behind BioVerge, is I want to enable more people to fund that type of technology that sounds like science fiction, but we're bringing it to life every day.
Welcome to Digital Health Disruptors by Charm Health. On this podcast, we explore the trials and triumphs of pioneers at the intersection of technology and healthcare. I'm your host, Ranjini Rangan. Hey there, disruptors. Welcome back to another exciting episode. Today, we're kicking off our journey into the world of biotech investing with Neil Littman, the CEO of BioVerge. Let me tell you, Neil's got this incredible energy that just pulls you in, and his dedication to biotech innovation is pretty inspiring. In the first part of our two-part podcast episode, we're going to dive deep into Neil's entrepreneurial journey, from his beginnings on Wall Street to the moment that sparked the creation of BioVerge. Inspired by the story of Evie, Neil's vision evolves and propels him towards a mission to democratize investing in biotech, making it accessible to all. We're also going to explore what's it like to be a health tech venture capitalist in today's fast-paced world. We'll uncover the common mistakes entrepreneurs make when pitching their ideas and discuss the importance of regular communication for startups. Later in our next episode, we'll delve even deeper into the heart of BioVerge, its investment thesis, funds, and the incredible benefits it offers to investors. So whether you're a seasoned venture capitalist, a budding health tech entrepreneur, or simply curious about the future of medicine, this episode is for you. Join us as we uncover the secrets of biotech investing, explore the transformative power of innovation, and pave the way for a brighter, healthier future. Welcome aboard. Hey, Neil, I'm very excited to chat with you today. We have met a few times at the Charm Health Innovation Challenge, and Venky's told me so much about you. And finally, we have you here at Digital Health Disruptors.
Yeah, Ranjani, thank you so much for inviting me to the show. It's been nice meeting you at the conferences over the years, so I'm excited to join you today.
I always like to start with asking our guests about their formative years, as I think it serves as a blueprint for the rest of their life. So if your parents had to describe you, the very young Neil Littman, how would they have described you?
That's a good question. Tenacious, I would say, would be a word. Maybe ambitious, dedicated. Focused. I've always been kind of a competitive achiever. You know, I was captain of the high school football team. I played lacrosse, did taekwondo for about 12 years, even went to the Junior Olympics. And I think I got a lot of that out through my athletics and sports growing up. And now I get a lot of that out sort of through my business, I think.
Influenced by a science teacher who left a lasting impression during his formative years, he cultivated a deep-seated love for biology. Despite specializing in molecular biology during his college years and earning a degree from University of Colorado Boulder, he encountered a pivotal moment where neither medical school nor PhD programs resonated with his dreams and goals.
I was never very good at lab research. I think I probably just didn't have the patience for it. Oftentimes, you become passionate about something that you have a competitive advantage at because you're good at it, and it's that reinforcing feedback loop. And so you're good at it. You get accolades, you like doing it because you have and achieve success doing that thing. I had to figure out a career path when I was graduating from CU. I was like, okay, I don't want to go to medical school. I don't want to get a PhD. I knew at that time I didn't want to teach. So with a degree in molecular biology, I was like, what do I do?
In the midst of Neil's career decisions, his grandmother confronts her own health battles. Caught at the intersection of charting his professional path and supporting his family, Neil grapples with frustration, prompting a dive into self-reflection and an interest to explore more.
At that time, my grandmother was sick and struggling with cancer. And for me, it was really frustrating. I felt like there was a lack of translation between what I was seeing in the research laboratory and the types of treatments that were available to my grandmother at the time and patients in general. And I thought, well, why aren't more things being able to be translated from the laboratory bench to the bedside of patients? So that really sparked my interest in biotech and the business of biotech and how do you move therapies from the laboratory bench to the bedside of patients. And right. So for me, that took going to Johns Hopkins, where I got my master's degree in biotechnology. And I learned about this whole other career path, this whole other world over, out there that was the business of biotech, investing in biotech, translating therapies from the bench to the bedside of patients.
And then from there, you dived into healthcare investment banking on Wall Street. And so I see this like wide-eyed focused young man in a tailored suit. And here you are giving financial investment advice. Coming from this Wall Street background and advising clients, how has that influenced you now as an entrepreneur and the CEO of BioVerge in the venture tech space?
So I joined Deutsche Bank in their analyst program out of Johns Hopkins. So I really knew nothing about finance or accounting. And so the iBanking programs that most of these large banks have is similar to getting your MBA. So, you know, they train you in sort of all the fundamental business aspects of accounting and finance. And through those programs, you get to work with a lot of different types of companies and meet a lot of different management teams and see different business models that are, you know, biotech or specialty pharma or healthcare services or med tech. And you get to conduct due diligence. You're seeing and you're advising companies on how to raise capital through the public and private markets, on strategic priorities and M&A and in-licensing and out-licensing. So it was a really deep dive for my years on Wall Street, sort of learning about different business models and how to properly finance companies to set them up for success.
While working at a biotech VC firm later on, Neil comes across an intriguing financial deal. A client manages to secure a significant forgivable loan from the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, CIRM. This loan can be paid back if the company succeeds, but is forgiven if things don't pan out. This setup really grabs Neil's attention.
Well, I said, well, who gives out a $20 million forgivable loan? That's a really odd financing structure. So got to know some of the folks there. And long story short, I ended up joining CIRM for a number of years. And the reason that CIRM exists is because it was essentially venture philanthropy in many ways. And so it was a very unique financing structure. And when I joined CIRM, they had about $3 billion of AUM to invest in an advanced novel stem cell related therapeutics, enabling technologies, infrastructure. So I led the infrastructure group. I led the therapeutics group there for a while. I ran business development. And it was really all about bridging the valley of death, trying to accelerate novel therapies from the lab bench to mainly first in human clinical trials. So that was a really amazing experience.
While Neil secured some impressive business development opportunities, what truly resonated was his encounter with an extraordinary young girl named Evie.
So Evie was born with SCID, or severe combined immunodeficiency, more commonly known as bubble baby disease. Children born with SCID don't have a functioning immune system. And so when I was at CIRM, we were funding a clinical trial out of UCLA, Dr. Donald Cohn's laboratory, using a lentiviral gene therapy to treat children born with SCID. And the idea is that we would replace the defective copy of the gene that wasn't working, and it could potentially lead to cures. And it did in this case. And so Evie was treated when she was about one. Fast forward to when I met her when she was about six. To answer your question, she would come with her parents to our board meetings at CIRM. And they would talk about her experience being enrolled and treated in the clinical trial and her life today, where she is cured. She lives a normal life. She goes to school. She has a dog, right? All things a normal six-year-old would do. And she has a normal life expectancy. And to me, I was like, wow, it was really incredible to see not just the technology that we were funding lead to something, but to actually meet Evie and to meet her family and to see firsthand the impact that these technologies have on families and individuals. And if you think about the sort of rippling effect, right? Maybe she has children of her own. Maybe she has a grandchildren, right? And so it says one technology could have this rippling effect across time. And all the people that she touches and all the people that her parents touch in their life, just how profound this one technological advancement is for this family and the ramifications.
The story of Evie really struck a chord with Neil, propelling him toward his next big idea. It inspired him to envision a future where democratizing investment in biotech fields opens doors to more people, granting everyone an opportunity to participate in groundbreaking innovations and enjoy their rewards.
This is impact investing, right? We are impacting the lives of so many people. And the technology was spun out of UCLA into a biotech company called Orchard Therapeutics that went public at like $1 billion valuation. Early stage investors did very well for themselves. So it's like, wow, this sounds like science fiction, but it's science fact. This is happening. Why don't more people have access to invest in this incredible technology and to generate the financial returns associated with it? And so that was my inspiration behind BioVerge, because I want to enable more people to fund that type of technology that sounds like science fiction, but we're bringing it to life every day.
BioVerge isn't just your average investment platform. It's a powerhouse dedicated to propelling startups in biotech and life sciences forward. Their mission? Finding the next big thing in healthcare and turning sci-fi ideas into real-world solutions. How do they do it? By bringing together investors and promising startups, BioVerge speeds up the development of groundbreaking tech and therapies that can change lives. But what sets BioVerge apart? Accessibility. You don't need to be a big-shot investor to join their expanding portfolio of startups and funds. In fact, they invite individuals to play a major role, almost like being a BioVerge general partner.
So now you've created BioVerge and you're an entrepreneur. What would you say your number one challenge was in the early stages of building BioVerge? And yeah, how did you overcome them?
That's a really good question. I mean, as all the entrepreneurs in your podcast know, there's no shortage of challenges. I liken it to jumping off the side of a cliff and trying to build a plane on the way down, right? You almost don't know what you don't know when you're starting out. So my focus at BioVerge has always been, because I have the investor hat on, is making sure that we source the very best deals. We have the opportunity to get into those companies and those deals. We give our investors access to invest in those companies that are really hard to access, that they otherwise wouldn't have access to on their own. And then we help support our portfolio companies along the way. All that has worked out really well and actually worked a little easier than I thought. Okay. I think the really challenging part was scaling the fintech aspect of the business and scaling the investor base and sort of the marketing, the brand building, some of the software development, all that stuff that was really outside of my expertise, I think were some of the biggest challenges that we faced over the years. So
what did you do to overcome that?
So my co-founder took on a lot of those areas. And so that was a big help. We brought on advisors and consultants and other folks that could help us in those areas. And honestly, a lot of it was just failing and iterating and learning and trying something else. We have this philosophy where we like to run, I guess we take a scientific approach, not surprisingly, but we have a very low cost approach to running a lot of different experiments. And so we throw a little bit of money at something, and if it doesn't work, we shut it down pretty quick. And if we see signals that it's starting to work, we'll throw a little more money at it. And so we're very judicious about how we're spending our time and money. And I think that approach has worked well for us.
Next up on the podcast, we'll dive into some exciting seed investments shaking up the biotech scene. We'll talk about the game-changing role of AI. And of course, we'll explore what's in tune for the future of genomic medicine. Stay tuned. Are you ready to revolutionize healthcare at the point of care? Discover the Charm Health platform, a perfect ecosystem where technologists and clinician entrepreneurs connect, ideate, and thrive. Visit us at charmhealth.com/charmalot. CharmaLot. Charmalot.
So I'm curious to talk about what holds promise in biotech investments for 2024. It's a hot topic right now, and there's a lot to consider. All the research is showing that biotech is likely to grow at a compound annual rate at almost 14% between now and 2030. What do you see as the game changers in seed investing, stuff that investors just can't afford to overlook?
There's certainly a lot of interest in genomic medicine, this idea of being able to edit the genome. And so whether you're using the CRISPR-Cas9 system or you're using prime editing or base editing, these are all different tools that enable you to edit the genome in different ways to try to cure largely genetic diseases. or you're targeting, let's say, cancer, for example, using novel immunotherapy approaches. And so when you think about the first wave of these types of like genomic-based medicines were obviously CAR Ts, right? And so CAR Ts are done ex vivo, right? The cells are taken out of the patient. They're manipulated, typically using a lentiviral virus to infect the cells and modify them. Then they're put back into the patient. And they've had amazing response rates and curative type response rates for hematological malignancies. And they've been game changers. But the process is time consuming, it's costly, right? Ex vivo, it works, I think, for certain indications, but it's not going to be the approach for all indications.
Ex vivo techniques have benefits, but they don't work for everything. In comes in vivo methods like AAV gene therapy. Here, adeno-associated viruses, AAVs, carry genetic material straight into the cells. AAV gene therapy is a game changer for treating monogenic genetic diseases. It also uses AAVs as carriers. These advances are changing genetic medicine, showing great promise for treatment.
We're already starting to see this of oncolytic virotherapy and high capacity vectors. And so AAVs have a limited carrying capacity to insert a specific size gene that is relatively small, but it doesn't work for certain indications like cystic fibrosis that has a very large gene, for example, or Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And so you need a different vector or a different delivery system, right? If you look at the COVID vaccines, right, they use lipid nanoparticles.
Lipid nanoparticles are like tiny carriers made of fats. These fats wrap around drugs, making a tiny delivery system. They're changing how we give medications, making treatments super effective and precise.
So there's a lot of interest with lipid nanoparticles to deliver these medicines. So the genomic medicines themselves, again, like CRISPR, Cas9, base editing, those are very targeted, very precise. The problem is, how do you precisely deliver them where they need to go in the human body? That is still a big challenge to be overcome. So we're really interested in technologies that are trying to solve this delivery problem. So that is definitely a big area that we're interested in. Obviously, AI is a big area these days. We're seeing quite a bit of progress on AI being used to do some automation in the back office, for example. There's a ton of hype around AI. I will say that I think there's an opportunity in some of the, I hate to say more boring aspects, but some of the picks and shovels. I know you have a lot of clinicians who listen to the show, but, and again, this isn't like super sexy stuff, but automated billing for reimbursement or note-taking or things that maybe free up the physician's time to spend more time with the patient and less of the admin work. I think that's a big area for AI. We haven't started investing in that, but that's a big area because we're seeing that deployed in areas outside of healthcare. And just to bring in that technology to healthcare, I think could be pretty powerful. Then, of course, AI being applied to the drug discovery and drug development process. Right now, we have a bunch of those types of investments. We're starting to see the first wave of AI-discovered drugs enter human clinical trials now. And so we'll have to see how they do. But I think it'll really help block some of the early pace of moving therapies into translational studies, IND-enabling study, to lead candidate identification, right? You're going to hopefully whittle down the most promising candidates faster and cheaper than you could have. Those are areas that we're keeping an eye on.
Next on the agenda, BioVerge's startup selection criteria, the key ingredients for top-notch startup success, deal flow dynamics, why startups' quality of thinking is vital, and the significance of scientists embracing salesmanship.
So how do you identify and really capitalize on these investment opportunities? There's so many startups out there. Yeah. You only take 5% of the startups that actually come to you. So how are you identifying them for significant returns?
Yeah, good question. It's probably even less than 5% now. It's probably 1% at this point. But yeah, it's a good question. Part of it is deal sourcing, right? There's a couple of different ways that we source deals, right? So one, we get a ton of cold emails and cold outbounds that are reaching out. Those are fine. It's harder to get through the screening process. So the warm intros, not surprisingly, are the best way to reach us, number one. And so we get warm intros from co-investors that we've invested alongside in the past, from some of our LPs who are super active as angel investors, refer us deals all the time. My single favorite source of deal flow comes from founders and companies within our portfolio. when they're working with companies, they'll refer us to companies that are raising capital. And that's my favorite source because I like to think that we're investing in the leading edge. And the companies that are helping my portfolio companies solve problems are at that leading edge of the leading edge. And so those are great referrals for us. And that's been a process, right? We have 38 companies in the portfolio now. We've had 7 exits. We've had 1 failure. So we've got 31 active companies at the moment. But even the companies that have exited, we still have great relationships with those companies and those founders.
Thanks to these strong relationships, they consistently receive top-tier investment opportunities, which they aptly term their internal momentum machine. But Neil believes the key is in finding the right match between founders and their ventures, known as founder market fit. He contends that the most successful companies thrive when founders' abilities seamlessly match the market they operate in.
One of the things I've learned over the years when we're thinking about making investment is this concept of founder market fit, right? And so how does the founder and their background and their expertise fit with what they're trying to build or with the company that they're leading? And sometimes on a rare occasion, you find like a perfect founder market fit, but it goes even deeper than that because oftentimes the founder obviously has to go out and do the fundraising. And so they have to be a salesperson in addition to the scientist doing the work. And they need to be able to inspire employees to join them. And so that's not always wrapped up in the same person. So how does the team, what is the founder market fit of that team? And do they have complementary expertise to go out and do all of the things that, a seed stage company needs to do? And that's everything from fundraising and convincing investors to invest in them to convincing top employees to join them, to executing on the scientific plan and making sure they have the right set of killer experiments set up that's going to reach the right set of milestones.
Neil emphasizes that startups should view things from the perspective and expectations of their investors.
As a biotech investor, when I think about investing in a company, we are giving a company capital and they need to turn that capital into a data set that is going to be more valuable than the capital that we give them. Like, sounds pretty simple at the end of the day, but do they have the right set of experiments designed to generate that data set that's going to provide more value than the money we give them to enable them to go out and then raise another round of financing?
Are you asking some really tough questions? How do you find out if they have this data set?
Through the diligence process, right? We're going through the data and the diligence, and we're trying to figure out what do they have? What experiments have they done? Have they done in vitro? Have they done in vivo? Have they done efficacy data models? Right. So we know, we've cured, I don't know how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of mice of cancer, but that doesn't often translate to human clinical trials. Right. So what studies have they done? If they haven't done those types of studies, what do they need to hit that next inflection point? A lot of it goes into just understanding their data set and how does their data set support their scientific rationale?
A lot of what you've mentioned is about experiments they've conducted. Where does the quality of thinking fit into this?
I'd say it's of paramount importance. The quality of thinking is critical. And you need to have a general idea and work backward with the end in mind. And is your therapy potentially going to be a monotherapy? Is it going to be a combination therapy? Is it going to be a first-line therapy or a third-line therapy? Because all those sorts of things really impact even your preclinical designs in many ways, let alone even phase one clinical trials to some extent. And so even though things change, it's like a financial plan, right? So why do C-stage companies need a financial model? It's 100% going to be wrong, but the key is to understand the thinking and the rationale and to make sure that companies are thinking through these things. So that part is really important.
You talked about founder market fit. You told me you had one startup that actually perfectly fit into that founder market fit. Do you have an example to share with us?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you an example of a company we invested in called Volumetric. So this is a really cool story. The founder and CEO was a professor of biomedical engineering at Rice University. And so he had launched this company, Volumetric, based on a lot of the research that he was doing. Volumetric is basically developing a 3D bioprinting technology for human tissue and organs. They had demonstrated gas exchange of lung alveoli, and they made the cover of Science magazine back in, I think, of 2019. So really cool science. Since then, they had a partnership with United Therapeutics to actually cellularize their 3D printed scaffolds with stem cells. And so the idea would be to eventually create transplantable human lungs that would not require the need for immunosuppression. So it's like really cool technology, but it was clear that the founder was an expert in the space. This is the lab that he ran. This was perfect founder market fit. The innovation was really applying the 3D printing techniques that have been done outside of biology. It's called projection stereolithography. It's really this sort of light-based printing technique that's been around for a long time in other industries. The breakthrough was being able to come up with a novel bio-ink that was not carcinogenic. And so Jordan, who was the CEO of that time, realized, and this is like the eureka moment, it's like a beautiful story, he realized that he could use food dye as the substrate to absorb light as the bio ink. So like he literally went to the food store and got food dye and ran that in his first set of experiments and made all this possible. That's a great example of like founder market fit and tenacity and to think a little bit outside of the box.
Next on the agenda, what lessons can we draw from startup setbacks, the importance of transparency, and the mastery of pitching for success?
I would love to hear a story of a startup that was a failure. You mentioned there was one failure.
Yeah, there's one. We look at, I think building the business, we look at failure as learning opportunities. So we did have one company that has shut down. And the problem, this one had great founder market fit as well. The team had deep expertise. They had sold another company in the space before, but they just couldn't get it done. I think maybe a little too early. Just really struggled with some partnerships in the space. And I think one of the big learnings that we've had over the years is transparency with founders, with CEOs. I think that's one of the things that we always look for up front. Is investing in founders who are transparent and aren't trying to sugarcoat things or aren't trying to say that everything is perfect and everything is rosy and that acknowledge the challenges up front, because this is a high-risk asset class. There's challenges, like not everything is solved and biology is inherently risky and unpredictable. And what we like to figure out is, okay, what are the challenges? And then what are the ways to potentially mitigate those challenges? Right. I think there's so many companies that fail on the business side or because of co-founder conflicts or issues. Those are all kind of terrible reasons to fail. I don't mind failing if the biology doesn't work. That's okay. That's why we're investing in the space. So we've tried to weed out some of that other stuff. It's hard to do.
Yeah. Transparency seems like a hard thing to figure out. Like in hindsight, what could have been some steps? Even with people, it's so hard to figure out.
Yeah, part of it is just going through the diligence process and just seeing how founders react to your questions.
Right.
Right. And I think that's a big tell, right? Does it feel like they're trying to hide something or aren't telling you everything? Right. What's in the data room? Like all those things, I think. There's just little signals along the way. It's usually not like one thing. There's just sometimes little signals that you pick up in during these conversations. But it's just a series of calls and it just takes time to over the diligence process to figure these things out. Yep. And you don't always figure them out either.
Exactly. It's an iterative process. So we have probably numerous startups listening at the moment. And I wanted to ask, what advice would you give to aspiring entrepreneurs or startups before approaching you?
Yeah, good question. The one that you always hear is do your homework, right? Make sure you know the fund and the partner that you're approaching. Make sure your company technology is a fit for what they do. I would say also ask questions up front, right? There's a lot of folks where we jump on a call and it's just, you immediately pull up the deck and immediately jump into the data and it's okay. But it's like a lot of this is relationship building. And it's always nice to just have a couple minutes up front. And if you're a founder, ask questions of the fund. Make sure you understand their investment thesis. Are they actively deploying capital, right? There's a lot of funds out there now that are not actively deploying capital and understand what they're looking for. So I think that's a big thing. Obviously, if you can get a warm referral, that goes a long way. You can't always do that, and that's okay. When you can, you know, you should go that path.
As BioVerge, you play a significant role in supporting the success of the companies that you invest in. Can you speak a little bit about that?
We do. Yeah. So we do not take board seats, but we do try to be very active in supporting our portfolio companies. And a lot of that comes down to what I mentioned previously, this idea of the BioVerge network. And so whether it's helping introduce our portfolio companies to downstream investors that might be able to lead a future round of financing, that's a big one. whether it's introducing portfolio companies to strategic partners and trying to get them in front of different organizations for partnership opportunities. Also in connecting folks with subject matter experts, right? So do people need to talk to a clinician, or do they need to talk to a regulatory or reimbursement or CMC expert, right? So we can reach into our Rolodex and try to find those people and help companies connect with those sorts of things. Or a lot of time that we spend can be on strategy. What is the right business development strategy? How do you think about licensing an asset or different assets within your portfolio? How do you think about building and investing in the platform versus the product, right? And oftentimes it just comes down to being a sounding board and having that open dialogue with the companies.
I'm curious, what is the average life cycle of when a startup approaches you to actual realization?
We invest everything from pre-seed to Series A. So we invest in companies that are just getting off the ground and have a little bit of data and like a deck and need less than $1 million to do some sort of proof of concept. And so those are very early stage companies, very early in their life cycle. Seed stage companies are slightly more mature, have more data, have done a pre-seed or have raised some amount of capital from folks before. And then the Series A companies are more mature than that, which we don't really need to spend time on. But I think time to exit really varies. So I think one of the big criticisms for investing in biotech is that it takes 10 plus years and costs $2+ billion to get a drug to market. So, okay, yes, that's true, but that doesn't dictate your financial returns as a biotech investor. What dictates your returns is when a company has a liquidity event and gets acquired or potentially goes public or has meaningful data once they are public. And so for us, our average speed to exit, I'd have to go back and look, but I think it's about 2.7 years from initial investment to having a liquidity event across at least six companies in the portfolio. So that's actually really fast. Most of those liquidity events have been through M&A. So it speaks to the technology that the companies in our portfolio are developing and the acquirers seeing the value and what those companies are doing and wanting to bring them into sort of the larger organization and help them develop those technologies under the umbrella of a much larger organization with more resources, et cetera. Identifying trends and technology early on, I think, is an area that we've had some success at recently.
In wrapping up, our discussion with Neil Litman, CEO of BioVerge, has shed light on the intricate world of venture capital in biotech. We've learned about BioVerge's founding story and its mission, gaining invaluable insights into the realm of biotech investment. For entrepreneurs aspiring to approach venture capitalists, several key pieces of advice emerge from our conversation. Firstly, understanding the importance of a strong founding team and the concept of founder market fit can significantly influence investment decisions. Additionally, transparency, clear communication, and the ability to execute crucial tasks are vital factors that investors assess when evaluating startup potential. As we look forward in part two of our series, we anticipate further exploration of transparency in the VC world, the benefits of investing in biotech, and a deeper dive into BioVerge's vision for the future. Stay tuned for more insights into the promising trends shaping the biotech industry and the opportunities it presents for investors and entrepreneurs alike. If you enjoyed this episode and want to stay connected with the latest in healthcare technology and entrepreneurship, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. Your feedback fuels our mission to deliver top-notch content. Stay tuned for more exciting interviews with visionaries, innovators, and disruptors in the digital health space. Until next time, keep innovating, stay fearless, and continue to be part of the disruption that's shaping the future of healthcare. We'll see you next episode.